It's time to talk about Las Vegas with Ira. Each week, Ira David Sternberg talks with the celebrities, entertainers, writers, and personalities who make Las Vegas the most exciting city in the world. And now, here's Ira.
The acclaimed Jazz Vegas Orchestra returns at the Smith Center June 17th at 7 p.m. for another in its series of outstanding new and classic big band music performed by some of the region's most celebrated jazz musicians and featured guest artists, such as my guest, trumpet legend Wayne Bergeron. He's one of the most respected and in-demand trumpet players in the world. For decades, Wayne has been a dominant force in the music industry. He's balancing studio sessions, film scores, international tours, jazz concerts, guest appearances, and educational clinics. Many first discovered his extraordinary talent when he became lead trumpet with Maynard Ferguson's band in 1986, earning praise from Ferguson himself, who called Wayne the most musical lead trumpet he had ever heard in his band. His recording credits read like a who's who of music, including Ray Charles, Barbara Streisand, Michael Bublé, Diana Krall, Earth, Wind & Fire, Celine Dion, Barry Manilow, Chicago, and countless others. Yet despite an incredible career spanning virtually every musical genre, Wayne's greatest passion remains playing lead trumpet in big bands. We're going to talk about his remarkable journey, his years with Maynard Ferguson, life as one of Hollywood's top studio musicians, and what audiences can expect when he joins the Jazz Vegas Orchestra at Myron's June 17th. For ticket information, go to thesmithcenter.com. For everything about Wayne, go to WayneBergeron.com and follow him on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And Wayne, welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
Thank you for that lovely intro. I'll Venmo you some money for that.
Thank you so much. Yes.
Just like I told you.
Well, I'm going to ask the most elementary question, which I usually don't like to do that, but in your case, I want to do that, which is what in the world got you involved with the trumpet? How old were you and how did it start?
Well, I'll tell the quick version of the story.
Okay.
But basically, my brother was a marching instructor for a drum and bugle corps in Linwood, California, where I grew up, which is just north of Long Beach here in California. And he basically was just babysitting me. I would sit on the sidelines while they're working on their field show and working out all their marching moves and all that. And I became interested because there was some kids out there just a little bit older than me, and they seemed to be having a good time. And there was a lot of laughing, and you know, and so I asked, how do you get involved with something like this? So they had a beginning group that met on Monday nights at the Linwood Recreation Center, and like a cadet corps. And I got my first instrument, and that was a French horn bugle. Like it was a French horn, but it was a bell forward thing for marching,
right.
A little different than your traditional French horn. I was in the sixth grade at the time. My parents took me out of Catholic school in the summer. And I went to public summer school to be in beginning band. They decided, since I'd showed some interest in music, to put me in band in public school. I got my first regular French horn, you know, a real French horn, which scared the hell out of me because I got this thing and it looked very complicated. I was barely dealing with this bugle, you know, trying to make a sound. And now they're throwing something at me that's a mile long of tubing and buttons everywhere and facing the wrong direction. I'm not really an acoustic genius, but it's a poor design, in my opinion.
Well, I was thinking French horn and Bergeron go together, don't you think?
Well, there's a French connection there, you know.
Yeah.
So anyway, long story short, my mom brought me to school one day, and the police cars were all outside of the band room, and our band room was vandalized. Hmm. So the graffiti, and this is like 1970-ish, you know. Graffiti to 71, graffiti everywhere, all the instruments smashed up. Now, I didn't take my French horn home to practice, so it got destroyed. Oops. and they needed trumpet players, so they switched me to trumpet. And that's so I should thank these people, whatever prison they're in now. because I had no natural ability on the French horn, but when I picked up a trumpet for the first time, well, just basically because of the shape of the mouthpiece for you non-brass players listening or watching. French horn has a very deep funneled mouthpiece, and a trumpet, this is a piccolo trumpet, but has a very shallow flat bottom.
Yes,
flat.
It does.
This is a little piccolo trumpet, a little baby. That's what happens if you put your trumpet and your flugelhorn together overnight. One of these shows up. But anyway, so there's a lot more resistance. And so when I blew on it for the first time, I got some funny sounds. You know, I'd go to play just like a regular note, and I was squeaking these high notes. You know, I don't think they sounded very good. You know, they probably sounded like somebody stepping on a dog's tail as opposed to something musical. But my band director, the junior high school summer school band director, seemed very impressed. So he ran over to the piano and he goes, "That's a double high B flat concert." And I was like, "Is that good?" He goes, that's very good for 12. You know, so I had this little bit of natural ability. I wasn't very good. I wasn't a natural musician. I'm sure it sounded horrible, but I heard all the other kids trying to do it and they couldn't do it. So I had a little head start with this, and my parents decided to leave me in public school. So I got into band proper when the school's season started. And the junior high band director, the full-time band director, was a very good trumpet player, a guy named Ron Savin, who's still alive and well and retired in Temecula here in Southern California, and became my first trumpet teacher. And he took me under his wing and he taught me how to, you know, relax my lips so I could play other notes. Turns out you need all these other notes. Who knew? Other than just squeaking out a high note. So he taught me how to play, and he taught me a lot about different styles of music. And we listened to a lot of different things, classical music. And I was enamored with Maynard Ferguson at the time because I just discovered him. So we listened to stuff like that, and Doc Severinsen, and then Freddie Hubbard and Clifford Brown and Lee Morgan and everything in between, Connie Condoli. He exposed me to all these incredible trumpet players. And at my lessons, we'd just play different styles of music. We'd play Baroque duets. He'd have me play something like a Dixieland thing, and he would show me how that's supposed to sound. Or something a little more old, you know, like Harry James, something, you know, with a lot of vibrato, like 1940s sounding. So I was learning all this stuff at a very young age. Now, I didn't know that I was going to be making my living doing this, because in the studios, that's what I have to do. I have to be kind of a chameleon, right, and be able to cover a lot of territory, because you never know what the music's going to be. Like this movie Leatherheads, for instance, it was about a football team in the 1930s. So the music was period music. So I played a lot of cornet on that, and you know, lots of fast vibrato and playing kind of like that, you know, as opposed to something like The Incredibles, was more traditional big band, a little more modern big band sounding stuff, and everything in between. So that training he was giving me then that I didn't really, you know, I just wanted to play high notes. I could care less about any of that stuff, you know. But anyway, He groomed me so I could be a working musician. So that's what I do now. And I get to do a lot of studio work and different kind of things.
Do you see yourself as a 21st century Wrecking Crew?
Well, a little bit, because I'm on a lot of things, and a lot of my colleagues are as well, you know. If there is such a thing, I'm on a lot of us are on the same things, but they wouldn't really call us the Wrecking Crew. You know, but there's a lot, you know, I see a lot of the same trumpet players all the time.
Yeah, a version of the, yeah. Right, because you're playing so much in the studio. Do you ever get, what's the word, not disassociated from the music, but for example, you're driving somewhere with your wife or family or friends, and you hear a famous artist, some of whom I mentioned in the introduction, singing, and in the background is you. And do you point that out to the people in the car?
Sometimes I'm not even aware of it because I'm not listening at close, but I have been like laying on the couch, you know, half asleep. This is when my daughter was very young, and she was watching like High School Musical 2 or 3 or something, which I played on, but I didn't, you know, I'm never going to go watch those movies unless, you know, somebody puts them on and forces me to watch them. and I'm half asleep and kind of listening. I was going, "Oh man, the horn section, that sounds pretty good." And I go, "Oh yeah, I remember this. Where does this sound from?" So that has happened a couple of times. I'm glad I didn't go, "Oh God, that sucks." You know? And I go, "Oh, wait a minute."
But does it put you in good stead with your daughter when she realizes that something she likes has part of you in it?
Yeah, I think she's, you know, she's 22 now. She lives in New York City. I think she's... Right.
No, but as a teenager, I'm thinking maybe, or as a younger...
Oh, yeah, she was proud that her dad played on
that's all these great.
Cartoons and stuff. So, so anyway, it's been fun living. It's something I didn't plan on doing. I wanted to be in a rock band. You know, I wanted to be the trumpet player in Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Or I wanted to be Lee Longney, and I've told him that before. I go, you have no idea. I wanted to be you, man. I just played along with all your records when I was in high school. And I played in funk bands and Latin bands, and I was in jazz band in school.
Right.
You know, but I got in these other bands as my playing got better and with older players, and I was learning about all these different styles of music. Besides from my teacher, I was out getting real-world experience, you know, playing that kind of music, which is very different from being a jazz musician.
Well, I would think, too, that it's a tribute to the public school system there that you went through it as a student learning music, and as a result, look at your success today.
Yeah, I was very lucky to have great band directors. My junior high band director, who was a great trumpet player, and my high school band director, who was a great trombone player.
Yeah.
So they exposed us to a lot of stuff. I mean, I may or may not have ditched science class every day after lunch to go to the band room to play tunes with my band director when he played piano. He was this cool guy, man. He passed away, you know.
Now, are you in the Linwood Trumpet Hall of Fame by any chance?
Well, I don't think there's such a thing, but
okay.
People from Linwood, you know, my colleagues there, you know that I've gone on to do a little bit of something. I also was in the same graduating class with Weird Al Yankovic.
That's interesting. Okay, so both of you should be getting the keys to the city.
Well, he's probably got them. Because he's, you know, a superstar. And great guy, played on a bunch of his recordings. And that guy is a good guy, let me tell you.
You mentioned earlier about who you looked up to. And then how is it that you went from just listening to Maynard Ferguson to then joining Maynard Ferguson's band in 1986? How did that happen?
Well, I was actually on the road in 1984 with this soul singer named Bobby Womack, who wrote a lot of tunes for, you know, different artists. He wrote Breeze In for George Benson and other tunes. And great guitar player and soul singer. He was fantastic. I was on the road with him, and we were in the UK, and I got this phone call that Maynard Ferguson needed a lead trumpet player, and my buddy Alex Iles was playing trombone. He recommended him, but I was gone. I couldn't do it. And I was making way more money with this, you know, but I was kind of bummed. I was like, man, I just had to turn down Maynard Ferguson, you know. What ended up happening is the trumpet player they hired didn't work out. So at the end of their tour in 1985, they let him go. They let him finish out the tour. And what I heard that he was doing a lot better, but they'd already given him notice. You know, he was a good player and sometimes takes people some time just to break into a gig like that, you know. And I started in January of 86. They sent me some cassette tapes and the book, and I kind of learned the music, and I went in for my first rehearsal, and that's how I got on the band. And Maynard was, you know, it's funny because I was kind of not over Maynard. I mean, I respected everything he did, but I wasn't listening to that kind of music anymore at that point in my life. I'd moved on, and I'm listening to a lot of different kinds of things and not so much high note trumpet stuff. And his band had gone a direction that, you know, it wasn't really my bag anyway, you know. So not that it was bad or just, you know, not my thing.
Different.
But I get on this band, and when he walked in, we were rehearsing some stuff, and then he showed up at rehearsal, and it hit me. I go, wow, there's that dude, man, that did all that stuff. There he is. He's right in front of me. And I kind of went into fanboy mode. I went from like, oh, I'm not into this kind of music anymore, to being completely into it again. And he was so nice, man, and welcoming to me on the band. And I remained friends with him until his passing.
All right.
20 years ago. I ended up on other recordings of his. I was only on the band for a short amount of time. I only did two tours.
When you mentioned about turning into a fanboy again, did you? I just envisioned you bringing some of your albums, his albums, and having him sign them. Did you?
Oh no, I didn't. I didn't do that till later. But I did do that.
Yeah, but did it. Yeah, of
course. After I got to know him a little bit better, yeah. So I have signed albums from him.
Sure,
and I have other signed things from him too. You know, and he was a good person, man. He was a fan of everybody's in the band, and he made sure everybody got heard and everybody got to play. And I ended up doing four recordings with him. Even though I was only on the band for about 7 months total, but he would bring me back. Like, they'd be going to the studio with the current band, and they'd fire a trumpet player or whatever. You know, somebody quit.
Right.
So they would go, hey, can you come to this recording session? So I just come play second or third trumpet, and they just plug me in, and they'd give me a little something to play. You know, lead part on something, and so I got to be friends. Then he recorded on my second CD. I had a duet written for us called Maynard and Waynard that we'll probably play at this concert. And he was kind enough to apply. And that was about 4 months before he passed. And then I got a call to go in. They were doing a week at the Blue Note in New York, and they'd asked me to come play. They were augmenting, they're making his band bigger. They brought four alumni in. I couldn't do it, but they were recording at the end of that, so I came out for the recording. And we recorded in New Jersey at Bennett Studios. It was Tony Bennett's studio, I guess.
Right.
And that was 3 weeks before he passed. So I ended up doing four recordings with him, and I was only on the road for 7 months. So it's kind of unheard of. And we were friends until his passing. His daughter, that was one of the first phone calls she made. She called me to say Papa passed away. So he's a big part of my life. I spent a small part of my life on the stage with him, but it was something I wouldn't trade for anything.
Oh, no, absolutely.
It was an experience.
Was there one thing you learned from him, or it's probably more than one thing, but there was one thing that stands out in your mind today that you took from his leadership or his knowledge, his talent?
I talked to him a lot, man. He told a lot of stories. He liked to talk. So on the bus, I was hanging out with him a lot. I have many stories that I can't even tell.
Yeah, I bet.
But
okay, go ahead. Go ahead, Wayne. Go ahead and tell us.
Watching him have to play every night. And now that I do some of this, I do some guest artisting where I'm out front.
Right.
And I got to play some difficult music that's very enduring. And I'm 68 years old now. I'm thinking about when I met Maynard, he was 58.
I have to tell you, you don't look 68 at all.
Well, thank you. But he was 10 years younger than me when I met him. And he was living a hard life. He looked his age, but he was still playing, really strong. So I would watch how he would survive, because we all have bad nights. And if you're playing every single night, you get a thing on your lip or, whatever. Maybe you shouldn't have done some stuff the night before that you did too much of, and don't feel so good the next day. But you got to go out and you got to hit it out of the park. So I would watch him survive, because I knew when he was having a bad night, where he was struggling.
Yeah, you're close, of course.
Well, he'd look back at us. There were certain tunes we'd play. He'd look back and he'd point, "You got it." So we would cover some of his parts for him, but he would do that, and it was very smart. He would do it that way, and then he would always be okay. It would never be horrible, but some nights would be magnificent. He would sound like he was 30 years old again. And so watching him survive that was a learning experience, and watching how he handled the audience. And even if he didn't feel like he was playing well, he never showed it. He always had a smile on his face. He'd make a joke about something if he missed the note. He'd say something like, "Ah, it's okay. Anyone you can walk away from," and the audience would laugh, and they've all forgotten that.
Right.
I learned a lot from that. I had to act on stage for sure.
Yeah. What about the studio? Was he the same way in the studio? In other words, there he's among his colleagues rather than the audience per se. And therefore his demeanor or his approach would be different, I would think.
He was kind of uncomfortable in the studio, to be honest with you. I mean, I'm sure back in the day it didn't matter. But as he got older, he needed the band roaring behind him. Like even when we did Maynard and Waynard, I recorded the band the night before in the studio, drove to Ojai, which is a couple hours from L.A., picked him up at his home, went to a studio in that area, brought the track in with my producer. And so we're in this very sterile environment, each in a separate isolation booth, trading fours and playing this chart. And it's a very antiseptic, cold environment. There's nothing, And we were playing, and I'm very respectful of him, of his age and his playing at the time. So sure. I'm not trying to grandstand on him or anything as a player. I'm letting him set the pace, and we're playing along, and he wouldn't do anything. Like, I wanted him to be Maynard Ferguson. Be Maynard Ferguson. Kick my ass. We'll edit that ass part out probably, right?
No, it's okay. You can
or not.
It's fine.
I want you to kick my ass. Be Maynard Ferguson. And it wasn't until I poked at him. So Gary Grant, the producer, said, "Wayne, just start going for it." So we got started trading fours. And then when another one came around, and I went, "What?" And he was like, oh yeah. And he launched in. So we did several takes like that, where that's what I had to do. I had to poke the lion's cage. to get him to come out.
He rose to the poke or the occasion.
Oh, yeah. And he played great. I mean, we did a few takes and we had to put some things together, you know, but all pretty good stuff. And it was just, you know, it was great that he did that for me. Right. He didn't do that for a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, there's something also said to be said, as Sinatra did in many of his studio recordings. He had an audience there of friends and relatives and fans, but not anybody clapping or yelling or anything, but they were there so he could play off of it.
Yeah, well, I've done records like that too, at Capitol Records, where they've had an audience there, and they would set up Capitol B. They'd open up the doors between the two studios. We'd be facing them. There'd be tables and candles, and they could applaud. And they were going to probably take it all out. Because, right. You know, they were kind of far away from the microphones. But it was so we'd have an audience. And we could do as many takes as we wanted.
Just out of curiosity, when you were in Capitol, because I was lucky to get a tour of Capitol Records not that long ago. But when you were playing there and recording there, did you get a sense of history being in those studios where Sinatra, Nat King Cole, and the Beach Boys, et cetera, performed?
Every time I walked down the hallway, that never did not occur to me. And the pictures are everywhere.
Yes.
As you're walking down the hall. Right. And then the great Al Schmidt, the engineer who just was camped out there basically all the time. All his gear was in the hallway, these giant road cases at Al Schmidt. And he was everybody's engineer. I mean, he wasn't the only one that came in, but he did, you know, 70% of the stuff I did at Capitol Records, he was behind the board.
Yeah, that's great. No, it's good to know. Well, you're going to be performing with the Jazz Vegas Orchestra, as I mentioned, June 17th at Myron's at the Smith Center. And you're the lead guy there. You're the featured performer. So do you know what you're going to be doing yet, or is it too soon?
I'll be probably taking some Xanax or something, or some Inderol or something. I'm as nervous as a hooker in church about
this gig. You know.
No, I mean, I know all these players, or many of them. I played with a, but I know it's a stacked band, you know, with Las Vegas's finest, you know, so it should be fun. And I've done this before. I've done this music with white noise behind me, you know, with kid bands. And I've done it with really incredible bands too. And, but those are few and far in between. I'm usually playing with kids, you know, playing with colleges or high schools, and they do really well, but there's nothing like playing with seasoned pros. My big band played just the other night at Club Vibrato here. And I do that every once in a while. So I got to have a band with amazing players behind me. So I'm really looking forward, to this gig. Actually.
And there's also, as I understand, a tribute to Gordon Goodwin as well.
Yeah, we're doing a couple of his charts. Matter of fact, that I have to look at. Thanks for reminding me, because I haven't played
some of
these things in years. And then we're doing some of the stuff that I usually do. It's all in the spirit of Gordon Goodwin, though, who was a very dear friend of mine. And we have, we have our 25 Years of Fatness CD coming out in October, which we did get over the finish line before he passed.
Good.
So I ended up being the co-producer on it and took over. I got it over the finish line, and so I'm very proud of that he trusted me with his baby. You know.
Oh yeah.
And it's really good. I mean, I'm kind of biased, but it's really, really produced great. This everything sounds great.
When it comes out, I'll have you back on again. We can talk about it.
I would love to talk about that. Yeah. So
yeah, no, that's great. Well, you'll also enjoy the acoustics and the sound at Myron's at the Smith Center as well. It's a great room for.
Yeah, I've never played there, but
that's why you'll be surprised when you get there.
Is it a jazz club? Is it like a club environment?
It's a cabaret. They used to call it cabaret. Now it's just called Myron's, but. The setup, they've just recently changed out the design, the visual design, but the audio has always been great there, and great musicians perform there. So I think you'll be very surprised at how good it is. It's one of the premier spots.
Hey, to be honest, I don't even know what we're playing. But I sent a lot of music to the band by email and to pick from. And so I hope they understood that to pick from part. We're not going to track. There's a lot of hard music that was never meant to be played right after the one, right after the other. You know, so.
In other words, it's not all of these. Pick some.
Yeah, so we'll do that. We'll figure it out. I'm sure they'll be prepared to play whatever we want to play.
Yeah.
And when we get there, we'll figure it out. And we'll figure out a good set. I think we got to do a 70-minute set or something. And
that's, again, June 17th at 7. I'll mention it one more time as well. When you were working with all of the – I mentioned the opening. It's almost too long of a list of all the great singers, performers that you've worked with over the years. And to me, you look like you're around 40. So to me,
thank you for
starting.
Thank you for that. Man, that's I'm somehow, my hair won't turn gray. I don't dye my hair. Right. Yeah. And it won't fall out.
Yeah, no, I was going to say it's a wonderful head of hair.
So my hairdresser, so I wish it would go gray because everybody thinks I dye my hair. So I'm like, no, I don't dye my hair. They're going, oh, come on, man. I go, I don't. So I wish it would go gray. And
well, then you would look too dignified. You don't want to look too dignified.
Well, there's that. There's that, you know. Yeah. No, yeah. It's said no one ever about Wayne Bergeron.
But about all the performers that you've worked with in the recording studio, more than even on the road, but is there one person that struck you in a way that other performers don't? I know that's kind of an oddball question, but in other words, everybody has a unique talent. Everybody has a unique approach to performance. Is there one person that you really influenced, besides Ferguson, obviously, but Maynard Ferguson, but was there somebody that, I'm trying to phrase it another way, that struck you in a certain way just because of their talent, their approach to song or music, or just how they connected with you?
You know, so more modern singers, I've done a few things with like 5 or 6 records of Michael Bublé. And so a lot of times, I mean, sometimes he would overdub, but sometimes he'd be with us singing. And he's really, man, a seasoned veteran for a young guy, mm-hmm. you know? And I really kind of enjoyed his vibe, and he was a cool guy. And I go, this is what Frank Sinatra was probably like, you know, when he was young, you know. So I really dug working for him, and it would be always be great music and great production. And but to be honest with you, some of my heroes that that I got to work with for the first time were people like the first time I worked for Sammy Nestico. Because I'd seen his name on all that music when I started playing. You know, he was on my first big band chart I ever played was the Queen Bee. And it's Sammy Nestico in the 7th grade, you know. And I saw that name all through high school. He was writing for Count Basie in the late 60s. So all that was trickling into my years in high school in the 70s. And then I did this, I think it was a Christina Aguilera Christmas record that he did some charts for. And I looked up at him and I go, there's that guy, man, like with Maynard, the guy that did all that stuff, man. And I ended up playing on 2 of his records and a record for Quincy Jones. I ended up being in his trumpet section and eventually playing first trumpet. And one of my prized possessions is actually, you can't see it, it's on my, it's in my other studio, that's right, is a picture of this chart called Bustling that he wrote. It's a flugelhorn trumpet feature. And he signed it to me, and he said, to my favorite trumpet player on this planet.
Nice.
It is definitely my prize possession of anything that I own, you know. So it was exciting to meet him and Pat Williams and these veteran writers that I was playing their music when I was in high school, and then to finally meet them. And I played with Pat Williams the last 20 years of his life on everything he did, basically, you know, on some capacity or another, you know, in the trumpet section or playing first trumpet or.
Coming full circle, isn't it, for you?
Yeah. Funny you should mention full circle.
Before I let you go, what do you want people to take away from a Wayne Bergeron performance? Is there one thing you want people to take away?
Well, I would like, hopefully they're a forgiving audience.
Self-effacement. Okay.
I will be perfectly honest with you, man. I am a consummate side man. I can sit in the studios and I have ice in my veins. I don't get nervous. I sit and I can play things over and over and over. But playing live and on stage and when you're the front person is another skill set. And I'm pretty good at it. I mean, I've done it a lot. I'm pretty good at it, but it's still terrifying for me. I'd rather be in the back of the trumpet section so we could talk about whoever's up front. Don't be talking about me.
That's a great way to leave it. My guest has been Wayne Bergeron, the featured guest artist of the acclaimed Jazz Vegas Orchestra as it returns to Myron's at the Smith Center June 17th at 7 p.m. for another in its series of outstanding new and classic big band music. And for ticket information, go to thesmithcenter.com. For everything about Wayne, go to WayneBergeron.com and follow him on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And Wayne, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks. My pleasure. Thank you for the fun interview and the good questions. And I'm really looking forward to this this concert. So I'll see you all there.
Good. See you next time.
You've been listening to Talk About Las Vegas with Ira. Each week, Ira David Sternberg talks with the celebrities, entertainers, writers, and personalities who make Las Vegas the most exciting city in the world.
Anything you want us to be, bring us your fantasy.